Hi there, I'm Duncan. I'm going to be taking you through the Unit 1 workbook for the Investment Management Certificate. This is the Investment Environment area. We've got six content areas to look at. Firstly, we're going to look at financial markets and institutions. This is to do with, for example, the stock exchanges where equities and futures are traded. Also, we're going to be looking at over-the-counter markets as well. This is where, in fact, we've got trading between two counterparties on a direct basis. We're then going to move on to look at ethics and investment professionalism. In fact, the CFA Institute itself plays a key role in setting guidelines for the best practice and the behaviour of investment firms and the people that work within them. Also there we have, for example, the Financial Reporting Council, which lays down guidelines really for corporate governance and other areas. We're then going to look at the regulation of financial markets and institutions, both at a European Union level, so the Markets in Financial Instruments Directive, or MiFID, and it's known as the main European Union legislation in this area, but also importantly at the local level within the United Kingdom, the Financial Conduct Authority, the FCA, plays a very important role, as well as other institutions that are more concerned with the systemic risks and managing those risks within the overall financial economy. We're then going to move on to look at legal concepts concerning investments, particularly here looking at such content as trusts, looking at wills, people dying intestate, for example, looking at the concepts of a contract. So, for example, a bond, the financial instrument that is commonly used for the trading of debt, is in fact a contract. So we'll be looking at what constitutes a contract legally. We'll then move on to look at client advice and the way that regulators seek to ensure that particularly retail investors are provided with sensible advice from advisors within investment firms. And then finally, we're going to look at taxation within the United Kingdom. Here we're going to be looking at such areas as income tax, capital gains tax, inheritance tax, and also corporation tax. Very important, of course, that when we're designing client portfolios, that we ensure that they don't pay any more tax than they are due to. First of all, we're going to have a look at some of the key concepts in the investment environment. What we've done here at Quartic is essentially to distill the most important areas in terms of the raw concepts really surrounding the investment environment. So we'd recommend that you go through these key concepts, get familiar with them, and this will help your study as you go through the official training manual and the rest of our materials. So first of all, we're looking at the concept of financial intermediation. The financial intermediation business, the investment management business, for example, really sits between investors, so ultimately the owners of capital sit here, individuals, household savings, etc., and they will generally move their funds into, for example, collective investment schemes, so pension funds, of course, are a very important area here, where saving up for retirement via this pension fund. The pension fund has certain tax advantages which encourage savers to put their money into it. The financial intermediation system then provides vehicles in which capital can be provided to borrowers, so firms, for example, corporate entities looking to borrow money, banks, of course, also looking to find financing, typically, of course, via deposits made by retail and other depositors, and governments, of course, through the issuance in the United Kingdom of gilts. is a form of borrowing. In addition to investments, also importantly, we have insurance. So insurance is a way that we can transfer risk around the financial system, and this is transferred to large reinsurance firms, in fact, as part of the overall financial intermediation system. So importantly, the financial intermediation system provides a service whereby we have this pooling of funds. So we group together the capital of these individual investors in order that they can get involved really in more types of investments, get a better diversification of their portfolio, for example. Also, of course, our financial intermediation system can be regulated, and this is really chiefly designed to protect the interests of investors, and as we'll see, particularly retail investors is one of the main focuses really of regulators of the system. So what are securities? Securities are in fact where we have a tradable instrument, so it enables our investors to get involved in investments in companies or government debt. So it provides the necessary financing, of course, for companies, firms, and also for governments, of course, via the issuance of debt. For our investors, of course, they'll be expecting to generate a return on their invested capital. So equity investors, we would describe as taking an ownership stake in a company by buying shares, typically on an exchange. So here we're specifically looking at public equities, in fact. I.e. those publicly available and traded on an exchange. Bond investors are essentially lending to firms or governments by buying fixed income instruments, typically over the counter. As we mentioned before, this is where we're trading instrument directly between two counterparties. So what's different about a bond compared to, for example, a bank loan? Well, really, the main difference is that a bond is more tradable. That's the key difference, really, between a bond and the type of loan that we might expect to see from a bank. Now, these buyers of securities, our investors, say that they have a claim on the cash flows generated by firms or governments. So I'm buying an entitlement via a security to the cash flows that firms or governments generate. So the key point is really this tradability, the ability that investors have to sell their claims if they need to. So this is where the stock exchange, of course, would come in for equities, and where participants in the over-the-counter markets would enable investors to liquidate their investments. So liquidity, all important really. How easily can I sell this claim and convert it into cash? That's the key point about liquidity. Now, of course, it takes two sides to make any market, and financial markets are no different. So a key point is whether we have sellers available to match the buyers who are seeking to liquidate their securities, and of course, vice versa. So what are derivatives? Well, very simply, they're financial instruments that are derived from others. So we base them, for example, on one or more other financial instruments. So, for example, if we look at forward foreign exchange contracts, they're actually a derivative of two underlying other instruments, spot foreign exchange rates and, in fact, relative interest rates. But the key point is we're just basing one financial instrument on one or more others. Now, the traditional role of derivatives has been to transfer risk between financial market participants. These days, in fact, derivatives are also used to trade risk and to generate returns. The main types of derivative, in fact, boil down into four different types. Forwards and futures, basically a commitment to buy or sell a security or some underlying risk at a point in the future. When we talk about swaps in the ambit of financial markets, what we're talking about here is in fact an exchange of cash flows that have different risk profiles going out into time. Finally, options are where the holder of an option has the right to choose whether or not to buy or sell an underlying instrument at a point in the future. So generally we find that futures and options are traded via an exchange. So in the United Kingdom, the NYSE Life Derivatives Exchange is where many derivatives are traded. Forwards and swaps, however, tend to be traded over the counter. Again, here we're talking about the direct trading between two counterparties rather than via an exchange. So what is a bond instrument? Well, basically underlying my bond is some borrowing by companies or governments, and also including banks within that company category. But the key point is that my loan is in fact structured as a tradable security. Our bond can be issued in different currencies, so US dollars, euros for example, as well as in sterling, and it can be issued outside of our own domicile. So we could issue a euro bond, for example, if we're a UK company, in the United States or in some offshore jurisdiction. So we've got here an example, my gilt, as they're colloquially called. So the terms and conditions, in fact, of my bond are specified here in my indenture. And this specifies really things like the maturity date, the point at which the principal amount is repaid, and the point at which this contract, a bond of course, is a contract, is the point at which that contract expires. Interest on bonds is paid in the form of coupons. Historically, we would have these coupons down the side of our physical bond instrument, and we would clip these out. So in fact, the investor would clip out their coupon and take it down to the Bank of England in Threadneedle Street, where they would receive cash in exchange for their coupon. So one of the main trading platforms is the London Stock Exchange. But really what a stock exchange is a meeting place for the trading of securities. So the London Stock Exchange facilitates the trading between buyers and sellers, typically of publicly quoted equity securities. So the trading would go on between the different investors. Here, of course, we've got the great Warren Buffett, one of the most successful equity investors of all time. So he might buy his stock via the exchange from perhaps a pension fund such as the Hermes organisation. So typically it's our equities and futures that are traded via an exchange. Our over-the-counter markets are where we're trading directly between buyers and sellers. Very often here it's in fact the investment banking sector that provides the counterparties. So in fact our investor here would buy and sell their securities via the investment bank, who are essentially acting as a market maker for these types of over-the-counter instruments. Typically corporate bonds and derivatives such as forwards and swaps are generally traded on an over-the-counter basis or an OTC basis. So you have two main types of market traded on stock exchanges. Order-driven markets, such as the SET system, the Stock Exchange Electronic Trading Service. And the other main type of market is a quote-driven market. So with an order-driven market, we have orders being entered by investors via registered entities onto a stock exchange. The members of a stock exchange will put the orders onto the system, and these will be automatically matched buyers against sellers. With a quote-driven system, for example, the Stock Exchange Electronic Trading Service, Quotes and Crosses, or SETS QX, this is where we have market makers. Market makers are obliged to provide a market by quoting a bid and an offer price. A bid is what they will pay you for your security. An ask is what they will need to part with the securities held in their inventory. So when we talk about bid and ask prices, we're looking from the perspective of the market maker. So what they are going to pay you for your security and what they demand from you in terms of cash to part with their stock of equity, for example. The two main types of order-driven markets, so limit orders, is where we specify the price at which we're prepared to buy or sell. In this case, we'll only trade at this specific price. The other main type of order, in fact, is my market order, where market orders are filled at the best price available. So here we're not specifying a limit order. In fact, we're not specifying any price at all. We're just saying that we will be prepared to trade at the best price available in the market. So let's see how that works. We might have, for example, an order book here. So here we've got a list of buy and sell orders. And what the system does is actually to match the buy and sell orders. Here we've got limit orders, so of course we specified a particular price. So buyers will not be prepared to buy at a price higher than that they specified. Here of course we've got one trade being put in at 495 pence, in fact. So our buyer will not be prepared to buy at prices of 496 pence or above. Similarly, we've got sellers on the other side of the market here who are not prepared to sell for less than 495 pence. So what the system will do will be to match the orders. So highlighted in green, we've got a 5,000 equity stock buy order, and we've got one sell order for 2,000 and another for 3,000. So the system will automatically match our 5,000 buyer with our 2 and 3,000 sellers, and the system will automatically match these and then execute and pass them on to the settlement system so that the trades will be settled. Other limit orders that have been set here will have to wait until they find a match on the other side of the order book. So my seller here, for example, of my 600 shares in Marks and Spencers, so my buyer, in fact, will be looking to buy at 493 pence. So he'll have to wait for someone on the other side of the market to come up with an offer, basically, to buy, to sell their shares at 493 pence. So market orders operate slightly differently. So here, for example, I've got a market order to buy at best, i.e. the best price available in the market. So on my sell side, on the sell side of the order book, the best price available, the lowest price, in other words, from the buyer's perspective, is this here at 493 pence. So what will happen is that the sell order of 11,000 will be partially matched. So of course we've got 3,000 that hasn't been matched, and that will remain on the order book until a buyer comes in who is prepared to buy it for 493 pence. Or indeed where we get another market order where they're prepared to buy at best. Otherwise, we won't get a matched transaction. So the stock exchange itself, in fact, is only really a meeting place for securities buyers and sellers. Behind the exchange is a clearinghouse, and this clearinghouse, in fact, acts as a central counterparty. In other words, they act as a counterparty to both of the parties in the transaction, the buyer and the seller. So in the example that we had a couple of slides ago, we had our investor here that was looking to buy 5,000 Marks & Spencer shares at a price of $495. That, of course, got matched against two sell orders at that specified price of 495 pence. But in fact, what will physically happen is that, in fact, my investor A here will buy the Marks & Spencer shares from the clearinghouse in the United Kingdom, LCH ClearNet. The London clearinghouse, in fact, provides this central counterparty role. Similarly, our sellers will, in fact, sell to the exchange. So this is actually quite an important role that the clearinghouse plays. So in fact, it reduces the counterparty risk of our trading via a stock exchange, because the clearinghouse is sitting in the middle of these transactions. So in fact, the trading via the exchange is really just the start of the process. Once the shares have been traded on the London Stock Exchange, then we'll have our central counterparty risk clearing. This is where transactions are prepared for settlement, and then the settlement itself will happen after that. Part of this process is, in fact, that there are pre-settlement checks to ensure that the counterparties that are buying have enough money available to pay for the stock, and indeed that the sellers have the stock available ready in order that they can deliver the stock into the market. In terms of regulation, governance and codes of ethics, the Financial Services Act, in fact, is a recent updating of the Financial Services and Markets Act of 2000. So under these regulatory frameworks, the regulators are really charged with preserving the integrity of the financial intermediation system. It's really quite critical to the economy, and particularly the UK economy, that people believe in the financial system in order that they allocate their capital in an effective way through the economy, i.e. that people that are saving money actually invest it so that firms can form capital. So the main regulators since the 1st of April 2013, the Prudential Regulation Authority, their role is really to assure markets resilience by monitoring systemic risk within the system, and their role is really to look at organisations that may present a systemic risk. The Financial Conduct Authority ensures that the UK's financial markets function well, i.e. function in an effective manner. Now really the focus, one of the key focuses really of our regulators, is on our retail investors and those in fact putting deposits with banks. These generally get the highest level of regulatory protection. Now, in addition to this regulatory oversight, the Financial Reporting Council is responsible for promulgating best practice in corporate governance, as well as financial reporting itself, i.e. how companies report through their accounts in terms of presenting information in a fair and not misleading way for investors. The CFA Institute itself also plays a very important role in promoting ethical behaviour. These again are on top of the regulatory guidelines that are there. So what do we mean by corporate governance? Well, really it's how well a business is run from the perspective of the different stakeholders. So the key stakeholders, of course, are the shareholders. So people who have bought equity interests in the firm, They are the owners, and they are really a focus in terms of being protected. But they're not the only stakeholders. We may have, of course, the interests of employees. We might be worried about the impact of the firm's activities on the environment, etc. So, under the corporate governance regimes, chairmen and non-executive directors really should be there to assure the long-term sustainability of the firm and act as a check and balance, really, to the activities of the executive management team. So the executive management are those actually running the company on a day-to-day basis. The chairman and his non-executive director team should be looking at the longer term, looking at strategy, for example, and whether the company is heading in the right direction. Generally, in fact, shareholders only directly influence management at the annual general meeting, in fact. So one of the key issues, in fact, that faces us in terms of governance is the separation of ownership and control. Managers, in fact, act as agents on behalf of owners of the firm and control the firm's assets and liabilities. But they may have a different agenda, in fact. They may be looking to maximise their bonus, for example, rather than the long-term interests of the firm. So this difference in terms of interest, the conflict of interest, is generally referred to as the principal agent problem. So the Financial Reporting Council, in fact, promotes best practice in corporate governance via the UK Code on Corporate Governance, but also it asks institutional investors, such as pension funds. So it demands of them a monitoring role in the governance of firms. Of course, institutional investors, such as pension funds, are very large investors from an equity perspective in firms. In terms of EU regulation, the key objectives really at the European Union level is to promote a single market, particularly in wholesale financial services, to ensure that the markets are open and secure, again the robustness there, and also to try to assure the stability of markets throughout the European Union. So particularly after the 2008 crisis, the subprime crisis and the collapse of Lehman Brothers, we have three boards have been created in order to monitor this risk across the European market. One of the most important directives, in fact, is the Markets in Financial Instruments Directive, or MiFID as it's called. So this is designed really to promote the free trading of investment products throughout the European area. So if you have, for example, an investment product that's been created in the United Kingdom, then once it's been approved in the United Kingdom, it can be passported and therefore sold in other European Union states. Other important legislation revolves around the UCITS, the Undertakings for Collective Investments in Transferable Securities. So these are tend to be to do with fund-related products and services. And particularly here, we're worried about the management of the funds themselves and also the standardisation of the products being offered. So under all, in fact, European Union regulation, all EU regulations must be adopted by the United Kingdom and other EU states, of course. So even if these conflict with national law, it's important that they are adopted. So, for example, the European Markets Investment Regulations was passed into UK law in 2013. Within the UK financial system, the main regulatory bodies, the Financial Policy Committee, which is chaired by the Governor of the Bank of England, really looks at the overall picture in terms of systemic risk management. The Prudential Regulatory Authority, the PRA, directly manages financial firm risk, particularly here looking at their capital requirements, how much of an equity buffer banks and other institutions have in order to protect depositors and other stakeholders. The Financial Conduct Authority is really there to ensure that financial markets, stock exchanges, over-the-counter markets, and the firms operating within them, that they function well. When we look at one firm taking over another, mergers and acquisitions as we call it, we have the newly formed Competition and Markets Authority, which has only been in existence for a year or so, and this regulates M&A activity within the United Kingdom. In addition to that, we have a city body, the Panel on Takeovers and Mergers, which is there to protect the interests of the shareholders involved in firms in an M&A. So we typically have a target firm, the firm that's been taken over. So the Panel on Takeovers and Mergers is there to protect the interests of both that target firm and also, in fact, the acquiring firm. In addition to that, we have the Information Commissioner's Office, really responsible for ensuring that personal information is properly looked after. So the Financial Conduct Authority is one of the most important regulatory bodies from the point of view of day-to-day business. So it has, in fact, seven blocks of regulation. So block one is to do with high-level standards, really expected of investment firms, including the principles for business, so how a firm conducts itself. Secondly, here we have our senior management arrangements, the systems and controls that we have in place, the checks and balances we have, for example, with regard to corporate governance via our non-executive directors and chairman. We have the threshold conditions that a firm must satisfy before it can conduct investment business within the United Kingdom. We've got the statements of the principle and code of practice for approved persons. So again, what do we have to have in place? What do approved persons have to comply with? And also whether or not our approved persons are fit and proper in order to carry out their duties. Also in that regard, there are stipulations with regard to training and competence for all staff in investment firms. Block three looks at business standards, so conduct of business rules, how it relates to its investors, for example, how it relates to the market itself, so how it trades on a stock exchange, for example, and also importantly, how it manages client assets, so where it's taking a custodial type of role, that it's got proper systems in place to ensure that client assets are properly looked after. Block four looks at regulatory processes, really the relationship that a firm has with a regulator that is supervising it. Also, it specifies the decision process and any penalties that might adopt to companies that transgress the rules. Block five is concerned with redress, so basically how complaints and other disputes are to be resolved. And also it specifies a framework for the compensation of consumers. The FCA also provides a series of specialist source books. The main one that we need to worry about for the IMC is this collective investment schemes. So this of course relates to different types of fund products. And finally, Block 7 looks at the listing prospectus and disclosure rules. So in fact, the Financial Conduct Authority itself is the listing authority within the United Kingdom. So the FCA specifies the requirements that you have to comply with in order to get your firm listed on the stock exchange within the United Kingdom. It also specifies the enforcement powers, and also it specifies the ambits, really, under which the guidance rules relate to. So where do we need authorization for particular types of products? So other important areas, particularly relating to retail investment advisors, the concept of treating customers fairly is absolutely critical. For example, ensuring that the information that we provide is not misleading, that we're not proposing inappropriate products for our investor base. So this has really been overhauled, the whole area here in the retail distribution review. So the system was really overhauled quite significantly before that point. So now, in fact, advisors are not allowed to receive commissions on the product that they're selling to make their advice more independent, and they themselves must hold a statement of professional standing. So a lot more regulation now in the treatment of retail investors and the advice that is provided to them. So in terms of classifying our clients and essentially how sophisticated they are and therefore which types of products might be appropriate to them, we have the MiFID rules. This, of course, MiFID is our Markets in Financial Instruments Directive, the EU regulatory framework. So under MiFID, our investment firms must very carefully establish their client status as either a retail investor, so smaller, unsophisticated investors, and here we're giving them the highest level of regulatory protection. Our professional investors are expected to be more experienced and knowledgeable, and we can sell riskier products to these professional investors if we can show and demonstrate that these professional investors are more experienced and knowledgeable than our retail investors. Eligible counterparties are really where we have investment institutions such as pension funds, for example. So really the firms here are deemed to be in the business of investment, so they should really know what they're doing, and these are afforded the lowest level of regulatory protection. However, the clients themselves, under the MiFID rules, can elect to be reclassified to a status that gives them greater protection. So our eligible counterparty could, for example, apply to be treated as a professional investor, in which case they get more regulatory protection. The same with professional investors, they could themselves actually apply to be treated as retail investors and again get a higher level of regulatory protection. Now the Financial Conduct Authority itself also has its own categories with regard to investment firms' clients. So retail investors are broken down into two categories. So we've got high net worth individuals where we've got annual income of greater than £100,000 per annum and or we've got net investable assets of £250,000. So also we can have a certified sophisticated investor. So this is where we're certifying our clients as being able to understand the risk. Only then can we propose riskier, more complex products to them. And separately from that, the FCA defines institutional investors, pension funds, insurance firms, etc., who may in fact outsource all or part of their investment portfolio to external investment firms. Now it's very important that the investment objectives of investors are carefully specified. So these are typically driven by three principal but actually interrelated factors. One relates to the time horizon. So of course for pension funds, what we're doing with a pension fund is to save up for our retirement. So for many people, of course, this is quite a long-term type of investment. The return requirements, really what we're specifying here, is the desired outcome that we're expecting to receive at the end of that time horizon. And thirdly, we specify our risk tolerance. Essentially there, how much of our portfolio are we prepared to lose? So other important factors that we need to take into account are liquidity. So where, for example, investors might need money at some point in the future before they reach their time horizon. So we need to ensure that the securities that an investor has got in his portfolio can be sold relatively easily if liquidity is an issue. We need to take into account the tax position of our investor and also potentially any regulatory restrictions that there might be for particular types of investor. One very important point relating to investment firms is the keeping of records, particularly where these records relate to pension transfers. So generally here we have to keep any records relating to pension transfers indefinitely. Within the MiFID framework, in fact most of the time we have to have a 5-year record keeping period. So importantly, we need to ensure that we've got a proper system in place to keep those records for 5 years. As a default, in fact, investment firms must provide appropriate reports to their clients every 6 months. So keeping proper records is quite an important aspect of the regulatory framework. Now, we'll come across, in fact, some key legal concepts throughout the syllabus for Unit 1, the investment environment. So here we've got some of the key ones. So where investment firms are acting on behalf of a client, they have a legal requirement, a fiduciary duty, in fact, to act in a client's best interest, for example, when they're managing their assets. Money laundering, so very much an illegal activity, is to legitimise the proceeds of criminal activity by laundering money through the financial system. Insider dealing is where we're benefiting from non-public information, which gives us an advantage over other investors in the market. Again, that's strictly illegal in the United Kingdom. A legal person is actually defined as a legal entity, including companies. And these legal persons are able to enter into legal agreements, contracts in other words, that they can participate in. Where we have someone acting as a power of attorney, so where someone has power of attorney over someone else, typically this might be in the case of mental incapacity, for example. Contracts are legally binding agreements defining the obligations between two or more counterparties. Bankruptcy is a legal status of legal persons, including companies, that are unable to meet their liabilities as they fall due. So that's a legal status. So someone can be declared, for example, insolvent, but that's really more of an accounting status where you can't actually meet your current liabilities with your current assets. Bankruptcy is a separate legal status, importantly. A will actually sets out how a deceased person's estate is to be distributed. Probate is all to do with the ownership of an estate. So particularly where someone dies intestate, in other words, they haven't actually specified a will, then the probate process will establish who is entitled to the assets of the deceased persons, their estate, as it's called. Trusts are quite an important structure, so where property is transferred by someone who is called a settlor, so someone who has the assets in the first place, will entrust them to a trustee who will then manage those assets on behalf of the beneficiaries specified by the settlor. Now the UK taxation system is actually quite complex. So here we're just summarising the main points really. Income tax, of course, we pay on our salaries, but also we pay on investment income from savings as well. So there are three levels: our basic income tax at 20%, there's a higher level above that threshold at 40%, and then for the highest earners, in fact above £150,000 per annum, there's an additional tax rate, as it's called, at 45%. Most taxpayers, particularly those at the basic rate, get a tax-free personal allowance of £10,000 before any income tax is deducted. Now, importantly, our income tax bracket, so whether we fall into a basic, higher, or additional tax bracket, actually determines the amounts that we pay under capital gains tax. National insurance, essentially here, this is a form of taxation, which is essentially a contribution towards the state pension and other benefits that are provided by the state. Capital gains tax is where we've made a profit on the disposal of investments, and here we've got certain chargeable assets on which we have to pay our capital gains tax. So for basic income taxpayers, there's a lower rate of 18%. Above that level, higher and additional income taxpayers will pay a higher rate of 28%. Inheritance tax, so where beneficiaries of a will are receiving assets from deceased persons, there is a tax due above a threshold of £325,000, and this is charged at a flat rate of 40%. Other forms of taxation: stamp duty is a tax imposed on transactions. Two main types here, in fact. Stamp duty land tax relates to land and property transactions, and stamp duty reserve tax is a tax on financial transactions, for example, purchases of shares. Corporations pay tax on their worldwide profits if they're UK companies. For foreign companies, you only pay UK tax on your UK operations, but it's profits and any capital gains that you might make. The main rate in the United Kingdom, in fact, is 21%, which applies to profits made over a £1.5 million threshold. The final form of tax is value-added tax, so tax that is added on to goods and services in the United Kingdom, and the standard rate here is 20%. So one important taxation calculation that we have to carry out is where tax has already been deducted at source. So this is called grossing up. So when we receive a dividend, for example, on an equity investment, it will already have had a certain amount of tax deducted from it. This is called a tax credit. So a tax credit is an amount of tax that we've already paid, in fact, but it's been deducted from the amount that we receive. Similarly, when we receive interest income from bank deposits, we will have already paid a basic rate tax of 20%, irrespective, in fact, of what category we fall into. So in fact, when we're calculating our overall tax liability and the payments that we need to make on any savings income, first of all, we have to add back the tax that we've already paid. So this is quite an important point here when we're carrying out our taxation calculations. Once we've carried out our grossing up process, we can then see exactly how much we've earned on saved income, on interest income, and then we can calculate accurately the tax liability on that gross amount. The actual amount of tax that we pay is this liability that we've calculated less the tax that we've already paid. So really a three-stage process that we have to go through in terms of our taxation calculation.